Do you ever feel like life is like a big slot machine? You wake up every morning, and it's almost like pulling the lever and just hoping that that'll come up cherries, or you know. And most days it's you know one cherry and two lemons, and next morning you kind of pull the lever again, and you just kind of live in this realm where it just feels like, man, something is kind of organizing life, but it just seems really random. Almost like it's a huge gamble, and sometimes you just feel like you don't ever really win the game of chance that is life. Do you resonate with that at all? That you struggle with just the random events of the world, and sometimes things happen, and you're just like, you know, I can't make sense of how, you know, life seemed to be going so good, and I was working so hard towards a certain thing, and then it just all kind of crashed, and it didn't work the way it was supposed to, and you know, just like feel like you're pulling the lever and going and going and going. You know, Solomon is going to address that this morning. That's kind of where we're headed. I quit gambling on sports in college because, now this is really weird, but to be honest with you, at Missouri Baptist College, the baseball team had a football pool, okay? It wasn't sanctioned by the school. It was just a bunch of guys, but here's what they would do. Every week they would put together this sheet. And for a couple bucks, you could throw a couple bucks and you get a sheet, you could fill it out, and you would fill out all the teams who you thought would win the game. And so every week there were, you know, and then you split the pot, and half the pot went towards helping pay for a baseball trip to Florida. The other half of the pot went to the winner. And so it was just this, you know, really easy way to raise money to go on a trip because we were all responsible for raising like several hundred dollars for this trip. So these guys put together this deal. And every week, man, they would hand out all these sheets. People were throwing their money in. You know, the pot would end up being around $250 every week, you know. So if you won, you'd win about $125 on average. And every week they'd put out these sheets, you'd see all these people sitting with their sheet and a newspaper or Sports Illustrated or the Sporting News, just checking out who was injured, what were the spreads, who was going to win the football game, all these picks. And here's what convinced me never to do this again. Back-to-back weeks in this football pool, these two girls won the pool. Okay, now, that's really not that bad. There's a lot of women that are into football that are, you know, to be honest with you, smarter than some of the men. By the way, I really enjoyed Daniel this morning leading. It was cool. But I do got to be honest with you, we are going to have to exercise church discipline on somebody who's willing to come up here the day the Cowboys play the Rams and have a Cowboys jersey. Anyway, he will repent publicly later. These two girls won. Now, I'm not saying girls can't win football pools or women can't win football pools. The truth of the matter is we know some women. I know some women who love football and are smarter than most of the guys who think about it, you know. But it wasn't that it was two women. It was how they won. Back-to-back weeks. I am not making this up. This is the truth of truth. They won 2 weeks in a row. The first week, they went down the list and chose the city they would rather go to on vacation. Let's see. Miami plays Detroit. The beach, no doubt. New York plays St. Louis. Who wants to be in St. Louis, man? New York. I mean, and they literally, they just went down the list and they circled all the cities they would prefer to go to on vacation. These guys are sitting around checking their boxes based on point spreads and expert picks in Sports Illustrated. These girls choose who has a better beach. And they win. And when they announced it, everybody was just like, this is nuts. So these girls took some of their winnings, $2 of their winnings, and bought another sheet the next week. And the second week, they did not choose where they would rather go to on vacation. The second week, in which they won a second time, they chose the team with the prettier uniform. Oakland Raiders are playing Tampa. Tampa has all these oranges. This is back when they had this, you know, Tampa was all into the floral colors. They have orange and yellows, and Oakland's black. That's bad, you know. You just can't wear black. They look hideous. We're going to choose Tampa. And for the second week in a row, these girls won the football pool. And it was right there. I put my money in my pocket and said, listen, I would do better to go buy myself a big gulp than throw my $2 into this football pool. It just, you know, sometimes when life is kind of like a gamble, life is just random and things like this, it feels like the people who ought to win, the people who ought to be victorious, the people that life ought to work for, it doesn't work that way. And this morning, what we're going to be talking about, all this, I mean, I know, like I said, it seems really out there. Where am I going with this? There is a phrase in the text, and the whole point, like when we do creativity, when we do Michael Jackson Thriller, or we do bingo, and we do stuff that is just different, we're not just doing it just to make you laugh and make you think we're cool, hip, and trendy, okay? We're always trying to draw you into what the text of Scripture is going to be teaching and help you identify and associate with that. You played bingo and you got all excited, and there's probably a few people here mad because you were down to just one ball left. You were ready, and then somebody called bingo, and you, in your heart of hearts, went, that is not fair. Some of you had like two spaces filled, and you gave up like the third ball. You're like, I don't win anything. Forget it. But what Solomon is going to do is, we're looking in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning. What Solomon's going to be talking to us about is this idea that as I look at the world, I look at my existence, I look at my experience in life, sometimes it really does feel like life is like a slot machine. It's just a big gamble, and it just doesn't seem like things go together. And sometimes the people who ought to be winning, they're the losers. And sometimes the people who ought to be losing, they end up winning in life. And if all I have is perspective, and this whole message is about my perspective, about your perspective, okay? If all I have is this perspective where I see life through the lens of the here and now, what's, as Solomon will call it, under the sun, life is not going to make a whole lot of sense, and it's going to look like it's just all about gambling. It's all that my life is a slot machine, and I just wake up and pull the lever, and I end up with whatever it deals me. But if I could take a step back and understand what the Bible teaches about this, and a word called providence, we'll get to this in a minute, the providence of God, and I can begin to see my life in the hands of the providence of God, see my life under the perfect authority and purpose of my Creator. Then my perspective can change, and as I go through the events of life, they begin to come together, they begin to make sense, they begin to connect. And so, you know, as we're kind of looking at this, there's kind of some beliefs, or, you know, and I don't even think people would write it on a piece of paper or believe it, but we tend to hold some views about this that are kind of common in our culture. One of those views is that everything's just kind of random chance. That's kind of what we're already saying, that, you know, that even flows from people's view of how the world came into being, how you and I came into existence, that it's kind of like Two-Face in the Batman movies. Every day it's just a flip of the coin, and whatever the coin comes up, that's the way it fleshes out, and that literally our existence is nothing more than random chance. And if that's how we view the world, then life is going to feel the way Solomon kind of points it out this morning as we look at the text. Another approach to this is just kind of this idea that life is, it's fate. It's like there's this binding, it's not divine, it's not that God is behind us, but it's just like everything is going to happen the way it's going to happen, and I just have no control over it. My choices don't matter. Life is what it is, and it's just whatever the twist of fate holds. You know, another view that I think a lot of people who claim faith kind of functionally hold. Like I said, they may not say it. If you were to pin them down and say, tell us what you believe about this idea, they wouldn't say, I believe in the idea of deism. But I think a lot of people who claim faith, who even claim to be followers of Jesus, are functional deists. Deism is the view that God created the world, created everything that was, and he kind of spun it and got it into motion, and then he went to Disney World on vacation. He's coming back someday, but for now, it's all up to us. And we're here to make the best of what we've been given, the hand that we've been dealt, and just kind of do the best with that. Someday, God will come back, you know, with Mickey Mouse ears on, and everything will be fine. But until then, we are just left to ourselves. And what I'm saying here, what I actually believe is that a lot of people who claim faith live their lives as functional deists. They live their lives kind of with this belief that I don't really know how to believe in the providence of God. the fact that there is a God who really is weaving everything together for his purpose. So let me define this idea of providence, because this whole message is based on this. We'll see what we're going to see the negative side of this in the text, but I'm going to take you somewhere else where we see the beauty of it. So providence, the word providence is the word, it's a word that means the unseen hand of God controlling all events and moving everything toward his purpose and the believer's good. It's the unseen hand of God controlling everything, all events, all decisions, all things like that, moving everything towards his purpose and the believer's good. Now, here's the deal. I'm dealing with one side of this issue. Let me tell you what the Bible as a whole teaches about this. On one hand, our decisions matter. The Bible's clear about this. We are not bound by this weird idea of fate where what I do doesn't make any difference. One of the great ways the Bible teaches this is that our prayers matter. When we pray somehow in the eternal decrees of God, our prayers are woven into the fabric of all that is. And our prayers actually move the heart of God to accomplish things on this planet. But the flip side of that is that God is sovereign and he is purposeful, and under his providence, his unseen hand really does control everything. Now, we sit here today and go, wait a minute, those two things are hard to rationalize. But we're talking about God and existence. We're talking about things that are bigger than us. And I'm not telling you to hold a blind faith in these ideas. I'm telling you to examine scriptures and just even look at your own life and see how, on one hand, yes, my decisions do affect what goes on, but the other hand, God even uses sometimes the bad and sinful decisions that I have made to accomplish his purpose and plan, both in my life and in the life of all of creation and history. And this is what the Bible, it's this weaving together of these two ideas into this beautiful tapestry that we can't make sense of it sometimes looking at it in the middle of it. But if we can take a step back and see our lives and see existence and see creation and see all that is from the perspective of God, through the eyes of our Creator, we can realize that there is a God who is in control and his providence does reign. And what it does is it takes us in the midst of those times and we begin to realize, listen, I woke up this morning, it felt like I was pulling the lever. But the truth of the matter is, there is a God who is bringing my life to his purposes and accomplishing his glory in my life. And so if you're a follower of Jesus this morning, this is the perspective the Bible calls us to. That even my sin, even where I really mess my life up, that God can and will make that beautiful and accomplish his glory and his purpose through that. And if you're not a follower of Jesus this morning, I would encourage you, as you're just kind of seeking and kind of peering over the fence, checking Christianity out, trying to figure out, is this thing true? I would ask you to enter into the story with us and just ask yourself, you know, is there evidence that God has been involved in my life, even getting me to Genesis here this morning to hear this message? That's the challenge, okay? And so we're going to take a look at this, but before we get into it, I want to tell you a story of our life and how this is kind of fleshed out. About 6 or 7 years ago, it's been, several years ago now, my wife was teaching at Baldwin Elementary in Baldwin, obviously, hence the name Baldwin Elementary. And she started doing this deal where it was called job sharing, where she was teaching with a partner, and it was a really cool deal. My daughter Alex was about 2 or 3 years old when she started doing this, and for a couple years there, my wife would go in and teach from 9 to noon, then another lady would come in, her partner would teach that same class in the afternoon. It was something Rock would allow them to do, and it was such a blessing. We felt like God had sent this opportunity to us for Heidi to continue to teach, be involved in something that she feels called to help with family finances. But at the same time, she was home for the bulk of the day with our daughter and able to do mom stuff and all that sort of thing. We felt like it was such a good thing from God that God had really blessed our lives with this opportunity for Heidi. At the time we decided to do it, it was major, you know, tightening of the belt, major making things work financially. But even God saw us through that and blessed us in ways we just couldn't have imagined. But after doing this for about 2 or 3 years, the lady who was her partner there at Baldwin came and told her, listen, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm actually going to stop teaching. I'm going to go home. I'm not going to do this anymore. And we had this major crisis of faith, this time where we were just like, wow, what do we do? Do you go back full time? What's the answer to this? And we went through a time where we were kind of even questioning God. God, we felt like this was from you. We felt like you were orchestrating the events of our lives. We believe in your providence. We are trusting you. But help us see what you're doing. Help us understand what's going on. And so we felt like the response to this, our choice, our decision was just for Heidi to kind of put some feelers out in Rockwood School District to see if anybody else had interest. Now, in our mind, this is what we planned. We're going to find somebody else out there that wants to job share, wants to do this job, and we're going to talk that person into coming to Baldwin. That was the game plan. Well, Heidi started checking and found somebody that many of you know that chose to be her partner, said, listen, I think this is a good idea. I would like to do this. I have younger kids. I'd like to do something like this. I can't really afford to stay home all the time, but I like the idea of job sharing. But I live in Eureka. I work in a school in Eureka. I want to stay here. And so we began to really wrestle with, God, is this what you want? I mean, that extra travel time is a big deal. That extra journey every, you know, there's gas price involved. There's all this kind of stuff. And after praying, just kind of saying, God, are you up to something? What are you doing? Why are you pulling us away from Baldwin here? All this kind of stuff. What is going on in our lives? We decided that this really was an open door and that God had kind of just led Heidi to do this, even though there was more hardship, there was a little more time away from family, more expense and all this kind of stuff. And so Heidi chose to enter into this relationship where she had a new partner at a new school. She left her old school, her old friends, everything, entered this new deal. And we had a lot of questions about you know, why is this happening? Everything was nice, neat, and packaged, and nice and sweet, and all that kind of stuff. But she came out here and started job sharing with this teacher who's here in the Rockwood School District. And to make a long story short, what happened over a period of time, is that it was the relationship that my wife had with this new partner and the relationship that we developed with some other people in her school that began the ball rolling to lead us to plant Genesis Church. At the time the events happened, we could not figure out what God was doing. But here I am 6, 7 years later, looking back on the events of our lives, and I see very clearly that God ordered the events of our lives, even in a time where we had a lot of questions that it didn't make sense. And I know this isn't like, I lost my home in a mortgage crisis, I lost a child. I'm not saying it's that big, but this was one time in our life where we can look back and see how the events of life were literally ordered by God, even though they were not what we necessarily wanted. And you are here this morning because of the providence of God in our lives. That God orders the steps of people, that he, while we make decisions and struggle with those decisions, that God is sovereignly over those, and his will is going to be accomplished, his glory is going to be displayed, and for those who know Jesus, he is going to work these things for our good. And I don't always understand how that works. I mean, I struggle with, how do you communicate this? Our next door neighbors for a couple years, people that we grew to love, they were one of these families who stretched themselves in the purchase of a home with this current crisis. But then right after they had, you know, they both had really good jobs. He worked for Chrysler. They were, you know, blue-collar jobs, but they were hard workers, good people. But shortly after they bought the home, he is diagnosed in a short period of time with both cancer and diabetes, has both legs amputated, cannot work. And I'm just telling you, I'm not saying this is easy, the struggle of how do you talk to people who are in that kind of life situation and struggle with it. But here's what I know. Those people love Jesus, and they understand this is the providence of God. Somehow, God is accomplishing his purpose for his glory. I can't always put it together for you. I'm not saying it's a nice, neat, easy, God's going to work it out in the end idea. What I'm saying is I want to challenge you to take a step towards God's perspective on things this morning and to understand that both the Bible and experience can teach us that even when we feel like we're just pulling the lever, there is a God who is sovereign and in control. All right? And so we're going to go to this passage here in Ecclesiastes to kind of see this. So if you have your Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. We're going to be dealing with verses 11 through 18, but I got to show you two verses that are part of the context of this entire chapter, just so it fits and makes sense for you, okay? Ecclesiastes chapter 9 will be on page 473. Do y'all like mixed nuts? I don't. You did. You enjoyed mixed nuts. You ever get one of these big old cans of these giant mixed nuts? You know what the problem with those cans of giant cans of mixed nuts? If you shake them, which they always get shaken in transit, or if they're sitting on the shelf at Walmart, somebody comes, you know, that if you shake them, the big Brazil nuts always rise to the top. I like to be the first guy who gets a can of mixed nuts. I don't like to be the last guy when it's nothing but peanuts left, and it's got, you eat them and all the little skin of the peanuts everywhere all over you. But man, when you can pick the Brazil nuts and the cashews off the top, I'm all in for that, you know? Because when you shake them, that's what happens. The big nuts just rise to the top, okay? Here's the deal. Here's the whole perspective thing. Life shakes us. When you get shaken, what rises to the top? And what will rise to the top in your life will depend on your perspective. That's the challenge of this message, okay? So let's look at his perspective. Solomon's perspective, life is a highway. By the way, let me just explain what Fremont Avenue is. Fremont Avenue, for those of you who are already wondering, is the name of the street of the Las Vegas Strip, okay? Slot machines, bingo, get it? All right, so he's teaching us that we are on a journey of pursuing God and living for purpose and finding meaning. We find that in God, but there are exits that we tend to be drawn out of, that we tend to take, that will lead us away from this journey of pursuit of God. One of those exits is just getting trapped in this view that nothing matters, that life is random. And we need to see the perspective of providence to help us with that. Ecclesiastes 9:1. He says this, first thing he says in this chapter, he says, I laid all this to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds, and here's the phrase, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know, both are before him. This whole chapter is defined by that phrase, that our deeds, our works, both the righteous and the wicked, their deeds, what they do, they are in the hand of God. And from our perspective, we don't know if life is going to be hard or blessed, but we can know that what we do and who we are in the hand of God. This whole chapter flows from that. So when we get to verse 11 and he talks about time and chance, which is where the whole idea of this talk comes from, when he talks about time and chance, you got to understand verse 1 first. He launched it by saying, we are in the hands of God. All right, but he's going to say, it appears that life is random, meaningless, just a chance happening. But he's already told us, listen, I believe things are in the hands of God. And then he says in verse 10, he says, chapter 9, verse 10, he says, you got to find it here. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might, for there's no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol which you're going. He says, listen, as you look at life, work hard and do everything you work at with all your might, all right? So God is in control, but our work and decisions, the things we do, we should do it with all of our might because those things do matter. See the two sides of this that we're talking about this morning? All right, I forgot to mention this. If you don't have a Bible, we would love for you to have one. At the end of your rows, there are Bibles. If you're at the end, just kind of take them and pass them in so everybody has a Bible this morning. In that Bible, we're on page 473. We're going to be looking now from that perspective at the rest of this passage and looking basically at a couple things that if we just see life from this perspective, under the sun, it will seem like life is a gamble, and there's some reasons why, and Solomon's going to point these out. So chapter 9, verse 11, here we go. Again I saw that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. There's that phrase, time and chance. This is what he's saying. Very basically, he's saying, listen, life is first of all, it is unfair. If I see things from the perspective of this world, of things under the sun, it will appear to me that life is unfair. Why? Because the race doesn't always go to the fastest guy. The battle doesn't always go to the strongest army. Life does not always work for the people who prepared the most, or they're the most talented, or the most gifted, the most able. Sometimes the victory goes to the least deserving. The guy who gets drafted to go play professional sports is the guy who didn't work at it at all. He just had this crazy giftedness. And all these other people who worked their tail off get nothing. Sometimes it's not the smartest person in the room who gets the promotion or the most deserving. Sometimes it is not the person who invests the most of their life into a company who gets the greatest rewards out of it. Sometimes life just seems like it's a gamble, and it just doesn't seem like, as you perceive things, that life works the way it ought to. And he says, it doesn't go to the race to the swift, the battle to the strong, the bread to the wise, riches to the intelligent, favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. He says, you know, the truth of the matter is when the day is over, it just seems like it's a slot machine. Pull the lever. And so you have people who, you know, they love Jesus, and they have this giftedness, and there's story after story after story of people who, like, in the athletic realm, thought that their talent and gift were a gift from God, and they were going to be able to use it to talk about Jesus, tell people about Jesus, and one cheap hit, and their knee is blown out, and everything they thought was a gift from God is gone. What do you do with that? And Solomon says, if all I have is the perspective of life under the sun, this world, it looks like it's a slot machine. Good, bad, you never know. It just could come up cherries for some people, could come up with lemons and losers for the other. And how do you know? It's just a gamble. And he says, listen, life seems to be unfair. The second thing he says is that life is unpredictable. Look at verse 12. He says, for man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare, so are the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. The second thing he wants to show us, listen, if we just see life from this perspective, it is going to seem that life is unfair, but life is also unpredictable. He says, listen, it's like this. This fish is swimming along, just being a fish, having a good old day, and the next thing you know, a net comes, take it, it's all over. A bird is being a bird. I mean, the issue of a fish being caught in a net or a bird being trapped in a snare is not that the bird was stupid or the fish was not real bright. It just happened. Out of nowhere, life was unpredictable. And sometimes our lives are like this. I mean, have you ever had an event in your life where you just think everything was in an order and it was supposed to work a certain way, and something showed up in life where it just, everything you thought was the right thing to do, it didn't work that way. And especially people of faith, you'll have things where you just, man, you've prayed and you've sought God and you believe, all right, I think I am doing God's will. I mean, I've got a lot of friends who are doing the church plant thing. I mean, they're doing what we're doing, where they really believed that God was calling. They prayed, they sought God, they spent hours fasting and seeking God and trying to listen to what God was saying. And they went out and they started a new church. A year, two, 3 years, they've invested their life savings, they've invested all this effort, and it doesn't materialize, it doesn't work, it crumbles. A family in the church gets mad, accusations come against these guys, and they're good guys, or there's just division, and it struggles. And after two or three years, these guys have to just close the door and walk away from something that when they started, I thought I was hearing from God. And what Solomon says is, if all I have is this perspective under the sun, I'm going to look around and I'm going to feel like life happens like this. We're just like a bird that gets trapped in a snare. Life can be just like a fish out of nowhere without expecting it. Everything can change in an instant. And we will see it as evil and hopeless if all we have is this perspective. And so he says, listen, life is unfair. Life is unpredictable. A third thing, it says life is unappreciative. He tells us a story in verses 13 through 16. He says, I've seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. He tells us a story. It's a real simple story. There's this small city, few people in it. It has a wall around the city. They've got a protection. But this huge army with the king shows up, and they circle around the city, and they begin to go to war, or they want to besiege a city. They want to conquer and overtake the city, and they do it the way ancient armies would. They form a circle around the city and starve the city out. They cut off all lines of food, lines of water. They take away anything that could come into the city. After a period of time, the city is to the point where they will either have to just give up and walk out, say, please take us as your slaves, but we need something to eat and drink. They may even turn to some horrible things. I mean, there's stories in ancient culture of battles like this where a strong army would surround a city and people would turn to cannibalism and just some horrible situations just to try to stay alive. And so Solomon is painting this picture of ancient culture and how wars took place when a large army would want to come conquer a city, but they didn't want to necessarily send all their soldiers over the wall. And he says, not only that, they are now building siege works, which means they're building these huge ramps that will roll up against the wall and then their men can go over it. It is not good for this city. And he says, there's this one guy by his wisdom. And what Solomon's implying is that there is a connection to God here, okay? He is seeing life from a different perspective. And by his wisdom, what the story says is that he delivered the city. Now, the story Solomon tells us doesn't tell us how. That's not the issue. The issue is this, that from the most unlikely of places, this guy who was an outcast even in this little town, who was the one who was the last person you would expect to lead the town to victory and hope. This guy steps forward with a plan, and the execution of that plan saves the city. And so now the city is celebrating. The other army has left. I don't know if they went out and made a treaty. I don't know, you know, if they, you know, came up with some kind of battle plan. I don't know if they, you know, had some other idea that caused, you know, They spread a rumor that, you know, the hometown of the king was being attacked. Who knows what it was? But the bottom line is, now the army has left and the city is celebrating this victory, but nobody remembers the guy. They don't even know who he is anymore. I mean, he's just off in the, you know, he's back to his life of poverty, just, you know, back to nothingness while the city is celebrating this great victory and they cannot even remember the source of it. And what Solomon's saying is, listen, this is sometimes how life is. This is the teacher who invests her life in a group of kids who are struggling, who are having a hard time, and you just give of yourself. And you want to say, listen, where are the people noticing that the long hours and the hard work and the day after day after day of investing in kids, especially when a parent shows up after one bad test grade or a parent shows up after day where their kid gets in a little trouble and now it's all your fault. And you want to say, wait a minute, I have been serving your child for 6 months now. Where's the appreciation? It's the worker who day after day after day goes into his job and does the right thing and does it with integrity, who honors their boss, who's the one who always has great ideas and throws those ideas on the table. And at the end of the day, though, it's the guy who's kind of the charlatan, who's the crook, who's the one who's always shoving people out of the way. He's the guy who gets the promotion. It's the nurse or the physician who is always just caring for people in the worst situations. And the only person they want to thank is the doctor who shows up in 2 minutes. I mean, especially people who are, you know, all into the you know, neonatal and all that kind of stuff, or the giving birth to babies. I mean, let's be honest. It is the nurses and the staff that do everything. And the doctor shows up at the last minute, pulls the baby out, and then everybody pats the doctor on the back and says, great job. And all the nurses are going, wait a minute. He just showed up. Now, see, in the birth of our second baby, it was really close. We really had to thank the nurses because our doctor went and scrubbed up at the wrong hospital. He barely made it. I'm not making that up. We were at St. Luke's. He scrubbed at St. John's. He's walking through the hallway asking the nurses where are the Hubbards, and they're like, who? But anyway, this is it. This is the way life works, isn't it? And Solomon is acknowledging this. He's saying, listen, life is unappreciative. It feels like if all we have is this perspective, it just doesn't seem to function right. And you feel like you invest your life in stuff, and then nobody cares. And so what is the solution? The solution is that I need to take a step back when life is unfair, when it's random, it just seems like it's out of whack, when it seems like it's unappreciative, when it seems like it's unpredictable. I need to step back and come back to the belief that God is sovereign and that the unseen hand of providence is working his glory and purpose in my good in my life. And so how do we do that? And I think the best way to do that is through the power of story. We need to look, first of all, at our own lives and see the story in our lives. We need to be reminded of the places where I string the events together and I go, wow, if I'm real honest about this, I have to know God was involved in making these things happen in my life. And we also need to interact with the great story of the Bible. The Bible itself is mostly story. And it is mostly a story of people who feel like they're living random lives and the fact that God is weaving his purpose all the time in their lives to accomplish the things that are for his will and his glory. But in the end, God uses those people to accomplish great things, and they experience the joy and the goodness of God in the midst of it. And that's what happens in the stories of the Bible. And so what Solomon is doing is he's already told us, listen, I believe things are in the hand of God. But he says, as we deal with it, it looks like the strong guy doesn't win. The fast guy doesn't win the race. It seems random. It seems like it's just chance. It seems like it's pulling a slot machine. But he wants us to understand that's not really how we should go through life. And so these last two verses here point us, and we're going to use these verses to prompt us to a story, all right? And here's what he says. Chapter 9, verses 17 and 18. He says, the words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. He says, the person who's just, they see things from God's perspective, and their words are heard in quiet, meaning there's a quiet trust rather than the ruler who is trying to exert his own power and authority. It's the words heard in quiet of the wise. So those are the ones that really are going to flow from a heart of faith. He says, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. He says, listen, seeing things from God's perspective, applying it to life, it's better than having the strongest army, because the strongest army cannot deliver us from horrible, tough situations. But a new perspective, seeing things from the providence of God, can help us trust God in the midst of them. And so how do we do this? The power of story. And I want to tell you the story of Esther and the story of Purim, okay? Purim, P-U-R-I-M, is a Jewish festival that celebrates the story of Esther. I'm going to read a few verses. I'm going to tell you the story, and then we're going to worship for a few minutes. But what I want you to do, flip over to page 354 if you have one of our Bibles or the book of Esther. We're going to look at a few verses. But what I want to do is I want to tell you the story of Esther in the Bible. Esther is set, and by the way, just almost hear me saying, and it just so happened. This is the way the story of Esther lays out as you read it in the Bible. The story of Esther goes like this. It is set at a time where it just so happened that God's people, the Hebrew people, were in captivity. They were living in the Babylonian and Persian Empire. They had been taken away from their homeland for about 50 to 60 years at the time Esther had been written. All of the Jewish people were pulled from Israel and Jerusalem and were living away from their native heritage, the place where they longed to be, the place where they lived. It would be like us being uprooted, and all of us were deported to Canada. All right, which would be bad, okay? And so now they're living in a foreign land dealing with this, and it just so happened that while they were there, there was this girl whose name is Esther, whose mom and dad had passed away, and it just so happened that she was brought up by her uncle, a man named Mordecai. And it just so happened that a man named Ahasuerus was the king, And this king, and I'm going to call him King from now on. We are talking about the same man. I'm not saying that name over and over. It will drive me crazy, and I'll eventually have a slip of tongue, and you will all laugh at me. Anyway, the king at this time who ruled the entire empire was having a party one night and got drunk. And he had a wife, her name was Vashti, okay? And he decided that he wanted his wife, Vashti, to come out and do a pole dance for all his friends. Not making this up, okay? It really, if you read the text for what it's worth, this is what he wants. He thinks she's gorgeous, and he wants her to come out and do a dance that is, a pole dance for all his friends, which is weird, okay? But this is what he wants, because he thinks everybody will think, hey, I got the hottest wife in the kingdom, that's a good thing. And she's like, I don't think so. That is not going to happen. And so this drunk king gets mad and makes this public declaration at this party that she's out of here. I'm banishing her. Well, once he's made this declaration, it would make him look foolish. It just so happened he makes this stupid statement, and it would make him look foolish. And so Vashti has to be banished. And so she's taken away, and she goes and lives, in Quebec somewhere or something like that. Anyway, so Vashti is gone, and the king's like, all right, I need a queen. And so he decides to hold this beauty pageant. He's going to have a one-year Miss Persia contest, okay? And so he basically tells his leaders, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go gather all the really hot, good-looking virgins and bring them back to my palace, and we're going to have a beauty pageant. And so they go out, and they start capturing, literally, in some places inviting, but in other places probably capturing these women and bringing them back to the palace. And it just so happened that they capture and they get Esther. They bring her back to the palace. She's now pulled away. Her parents were dead. She's grown up, raised by her uncle Mordecai, but now she's pulled away from that. And it just so happened that she is taken to the palace. And for 6 months, they try to make her beautiful. I'm not sure what that says, but this is what goes on. She goes through this, it's a year. 6 months, they work on the way she smells. And 6 months, they work on the way she looks, okay? So, I don't know, a little band deodorant and some makeup, maybe that would have done it, but they really make her gorgeous. It's time for the beauty pageant, and it just so happened that the king thought she was the best-looking one and chooses Esther to be the queen. And at this time, she did not reveal to anybody that she was Jewish, that this was her nationality, but the king chooses her. And so Esther becomes the queen of this empire under this king. As this goes on, Mordecai is working as kind of a person who, probably cleans up trash and is just kind of maybe a janitor outside the palace of the king. And it just so happened that Mordecai one day is working and he sees two guys talking and he happens to hear them in a conversation. And the conversation is a discussion about an assassination of this king. And so Mordecai goes in and informs some of the temple guard. And the temple guard here, they bring Mordecai into the king's presence. And the king, Mordecai, explains to the king what took place. And the king gets so nervous about his life that he does the same thing to Mordecai here that the text we just read did to the poor wise man. He saves his life. They catch these guys. They are executed. But he forgets all about Mordecai. And so here's Mordecai, the honorable guy who totally gets dissed and nobody remembers what he did. Mordecai goes on about his life. Esther's now the king. But there's this the bad guy, Haman, okay? I mean, that just name sounds like Hanan. In fact, the Bible keeps calling him Hanad the Agagite. It just sounds like a villain, Ooh, hiss. In fact, as the Hebrew people celebrate Purim, they start every time Haman is named in the story, they start stomping the ground and hissing and hitting these rattlers because they're like, ooh, boo, hiss, bad guy, And so Haman comes in, and Haman's deal is that he is walking in every day, and he's like the second guy in command to the king. He expects everybody just to kneel and bow down and worship him, but Mordecai won't. Mordecai worships God. And he will not bow down to anybody. So Mordecai will not bow at the feet of this ruler. He won't worship this ruler, which really gets under Haman's skin. He's mad. He's arrogant. He wants everybody to think he is the best thing since sliced bread. And he gets really frustrated with Mordecai. And so he comes up with this crazy plan. And the plan is this. I'm not just going to get Mordecai. I'm getting all of his people. And he gets the king once again to drink a little bit and throws out this idea. And the idea is, God, there's this one group of people, there's one group of people in your kingdom that are just always disobeying your rules. They're always just making a mess. They're always causing trouble. I think that you ought to deal with them. And so Haman gets together with his cohorts in crime. These guys are kind of his henchmen. And they hold this time where they start thinking, how can we do this plan? And they do a game of chance. They do a little gambling. And what they do is they start throwing lots or almost like dice. And in Esther chapter 3, verse 7, it tells us what goes on here. Look at what happens. This is so key to the story. Esther chapter 3, verse 7, it says, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, that's a Jewish month, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, there it is again, I'm not saying it anymore, they cast Pur, that is, they cast lots before Haman that day, before Haman day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Now, here's what they did. They started playing a dice game. They're rolling dice, and it's like, all right, if it comes up 7 or 11, that's the day all the Jews are going to die. They just keep rolling the dice, but it never comes up 7 or 11. It never comes up with the right numbers. The lot doesn't fall on any day. They just keep going through the calendar day after day after day, saying, fate has got to eventually give us a day that is the day we should have all the Jews exiled or executed. And finally, 12 months out, they come up with a day. Finally, 7, they roll 7. All right, woohoo! Oh, man, we've rolled these dice 1,000 times. Finally, we got a day, actually 360-something times because it was 12 months out. Finally, we got a day. This is the day. And they see that as a sign of fate. They go into the king, and the king goes, yeah, I think that's a good idea. These people, if you think they're like this, I agree. And he puts signs his name to a document that says all the Jews must die. Tough stuff. It just so happened that at this point in time, Mordecai gets back in touch with Esther and says, listen, things are not good. There's been an edict. And her response is, listen, you need to understand. If somebody goes before the king, he can, for any reason, just take their head off. I mean, think about what happened to the previous lady who had my job. It doesn't take much to get this guy kind of nervous and freaked out. If I go in there, he could just, he could raise my head off. And Mordecai has a conversation with her. And in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, this is what he says to her. He says, then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than any of the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And here's a key phrase, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Now, here's what's interesting about the entire book of Esther. It's the only book in the Bible where the name of God is not mentioned. God is not mentioned in the book, but the entire book is about God and providence. It just so happens that Esther says, I think, yeah, I'm supposed to be here for this time, and she organizes this deal. And it's a long story. I won't tell the whole story, but the bottom line is Esther goes in and has a conversation with, she holds a banquet for the king and for Haman. And the first time she holds this banquet for him, she kind of chickens out. She was going to tell him what Haman had done, but she just can't do it. And the king goes, what is it that you want? And she says, I want to hold a banquet for you again tomorrow night. She just couldn't get it out. She couldn't say to the king what was going on. And so she holds a second banquet. And the night after the first banquet, after, the king once again had a little bit too much to drink, he couldn't sleep. And in the middle of the night when he can't sleep, it just so happened that he couldn't sleep. He goes back and he wants to read about all his great exploits. He wants to go read how wonderful he is. And he goes back to this book called the Book of Memories. And he starts reading through the book of all the things he does. But he comes to this page where he is reminded that this guy saved his life. And so the king goes to Haman and goes, dude, What should I do for somebody I really want to bless and I want to honor? And Haman, this arrogant guy, thinks, hey, he's talking about me. And Haman says, you ought to do this huge honking parade, put him on a white horse, give him your royal clothes, make it real cool where everybody thinks he is the coolest thing in the world. And the king looks at him and goes, well, cool. You go do that for Mordecai. Now this guy that he despises who won't bow down, he has to lead him around the city on a white horse. And it makes him even more angry. And he goes and he builds a gallows for Mordecai as this day is approaching that the king has set. And the bottom line is that eventually, that night actually, as he right after he has led Mordecai through the city, it just so happened at the banquet that finally Esther tells the king what is going on. Haman is dealt with because of his weakness, and the king reverses his decision and actually sends out an edict of prosperity for the Jewish people. Now, all the way through here, the hand of God is there, but it's not spoken. But God orchestrates the events of these people's lives so that they were in the place that he designed and he accomplished his glory and their good. And so what happens to this day, Jews in March will celebrate the festival of Purim. And if you picked up on it, you will notice that the word, the name for the festival comes from the name of the dice game. And this is what they're saying. Every time they celebrate it, every Purim, it's a big festival. They eat, they party, they have a good time, but they also read the story of Esther. Every time they read Haman's name, there's this bang on things, this stomping on ground, boo, hiss, you know, it's kind of like the old cartoons where people would do that. And, you know, when Mordecai's read, we're cheering, we feel good, and they know where the story's going, but the name of the festival comes from the fact that God even ordered the dice game for his glory. And that's my challenge to you today. I'm way out of time. I got to let the band come out. We got to celebrate Jesus because it's all about him. Because the Bible also tells us the story of the cross looked like this. That evil was winning, that it wasn't going to work. And the Bible tells us that God was orchestrating even those events for his purpose and the good of his people and for his glory. This morning, I just want to challenge you. Find Jesus and get a new perspective. Because I'm sure, man, the crisis of our economy, we all are going, man, it feels like I'm pulling a lever and it's not working. Get a new perspective this morning. The providence of God. There is an unseen hand who is ordering your life. If you know Christ, if you have a relationship with God, he is ordering your life. He is even using your mistakes and sin to accomplish his good and to create beauty. All right? I'm going to pray. The band's going to come out here. We're going to celebrate God. We take up an offering as part of worship as a way for us to say, listen, God has given so much to us, and we are just going to celebrate by giving back to him. If you're a guest, we do not want or ask you to give, but it's for those who are part of Genesis to return to God and just say, God, you've blessed us so much as an act of worship. We're going to sing, and while we're doing it, I just pray, ask you to just kind of seek your heart and say, God, I'm in the midst of something that's times that are really hard. Help me gain a new perspective and see things maybe the way you see them this morning. Lord, I praise you. I love you. I honor you. Thank you for your grace. Lord, this morning, I just pray that we will get a new perspective on grace and mercy and goodness and providence. In your name I pray. Amen.